Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Michael Dresser Show. There's no topic this program is afraid to address or investigate, whether it be social, political, or current events, including some very sensitive cultural issues of today. The views expressed by the host, guest, and callers do not necessarily reflect the views of this station. Now, step into the realm of clarity with your host, Michael Dresser.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to The Michael Dresser Show. T.D. Thornton with us. The book of, he is the author of, The Adventures with Your Money, My Adventures with Your Money, George Graham Rice, and The Golden Age of the Con Artist. T.D. is the author of Not a Long Shot, A Season at a Hard Luck Horse Track. He's a freelance correspondent for the Boston Globe. He's written for the New York Times and Slate. His creative nonfiction, fiction, and poetry have been published in McSweeney's, Jabberwock, and the Raven Chronicles. And let us say, T.D., hi, welcome to the show.
Hi, Michael. Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. My Adventures with Your Money, George Graham Rice. When we really come down to it, if we go back through history, there is a lot of people who have done a lot of things with our money, haven't they?
That's correct. And in a lot of circumstances, they're not things that you would want done with your money. In the case of George Graham Rice, he took it and pocketed it and spent it.
Now, by the way, when we're dealing with these kind of things, and we still see it today, why George Graham Rice? Why did you pick him above the rest of them?
You know, George Graham Rice, I think, kind of found me rather than me finding him. And to rewind it, we have to go back to the summer of 2011, 4 years ago, when I was researching, I'm a serial Googler, and I was researching online the topic of con artistry for a magazine piece that I was working on, which subsequently didn't even get written because I was so smitten with what I found about George Graham Rice. But I had always had this interest in the shadow world of con artistry and confidence hustling. And I came across an article from Time magazine in 1934, and that news clip profiled a past his prime grifter named George Graham Rice, and it portrayed him as the iconic swindler of the early 20th century. And despite my fascination with the shadow world of confident hustling, I had never heard of George Graham Rice. And when I did a quick skim of the internet, I found out that here in the 21st century, hardly anyone else had ever heard of him either. You know, it's almost unheard of in this day and age for even minor characters in history have a Wikipedia page or a number of other links or a number of ways you can trace their history. But there was almost nothing for Rice. And as I went back to the archives, I found out here was a guy who was an infamous hustler who was front page news between like 1900 and 1930. And I had wondered if he was such an infamous figure that he had conned so many people out of tens of millions of dollars, probably the equivalent of what Bernie Madoff swindled today in billions of dollars, and I wanted to know why had his legacy evaporated. And over the next 4 years, I aimed to find out, and the deeper I dug, the more intriguing and compelling George Graham Rice became to me. And I would have to say that you know, his arc as a hustler pretty much coincides with what we know of today as the golden age of con artistry, and I peg that at roughly between 1870 and 1940. And one of the things that really surprised me about researching George Graham Rice was here is a guy that under all circumstances, based on the facts of how he ripped people off, he's not a very likable person. Yet George Graham Rice fascinated me. And I wondered if even, you know, he was the ultimate anti-hero from what I can understand. And I kind of wonder now that the book has been written, I wonder if I too have been suckered by George Graham Rice in the fact that he pulled me in and really intrigued me, and I'm hoping that's what he does for readers of My Adventures with Your Money. And I guess that's the litmus test for a true con artist. His power, in the case of George Graham Rice, to me, extended beyond the grave.
You know, when it comes down to a TD, these people take our money, they steal from us. You know, there's many people who have ended up, you know, desolate because of it, but there's still that fascination. What is that about that? They write movies, they make millions of dollars telling us about people, billions of dollars telling us about people who are taking from us and doing these bad things to us, and we buy. What is that fascination?
Yeah, that's something that I tried to get to the root of in my adventures with Your Money. And the closest that I can come up with is a lot of it is attributed to the passage of time. I mean, Rice did some nasty things to people and wrecked, you know, let's speak frankly, he wrecked a lot of lives between 1900 and his death in 1943. And he just robbed the nation of suckers blind, and he blithely referred to them as suckers. He didn't have much remorse. And part of his allure as a subject today can be attributed to, I think in America, we have this current fascination with crimes and criminals from earlier eras. For example, you look at an HBO television show like Boardwalk Empire, which similarly profiled ruthless criminals from the era of the 19-teens and 1920s. And it's something I think about that temporal distance where they're not ripping us off in the here and now, so we kind of look back at them as a little bit more charismatic, a little more colorful. You know, in the 1920s, the term con artistry didn't at all conjure up the romantic imagery that we have today, maybe with a Sharpie and a fedora, somebody like a character in the movie The Sting, who is deft and adept at making us think that we've lost our money through maybe our own mistake or a run of bad luck. And the haze of nostalgia now ends kind of an aura of mystery to that same way of life. And the other thing is, the reality is, I think a lot of those criminals back in the day were a lot more charismatic. You take, for example, Bernie Madoff and his ilk, you know, the villains of Wall Street today, when they get arrested for their crimes, they put a sport coat or a jacket over their head, and they're walked out in the perp walk, and their attorney is by them uttering no comment. And somebody like George Graham Rice, when he was accused of crime in Wall Street, he literally stood up on a discarded fruit box, whipped out a roll of $1,000 bills, and held it up to the crowd and inflamed them and said, there's plenty more where this came from. I'm not broke. I'm not stealing your money. I'm not insolvent. And people ate it up, and he was very charismatic, and that was part of his allure as a con artist, then and now.
Now, by the way, they're brilliant. Would you imagine taking that artistry, you know, let's call him an artist, that artistry and that brilliance and putting it into something positive, they who knows what they would have done. But to do this isn't just to do this. You get guys like this, them in and of themselves, I'm going to use the word again, they're brilliant to do what they do. That doesn't mean it's a nice thing, but at the same time, you know, they're worshipped and their legacy has been kept open and will stay open. Look at what they've done with the mafia. Same thing.
I would agree with you on that, Michael. And I think in the case of George Graham Rice, he was a guy who, by all accounts, was a brilliant businessman. And it just ended up that he happened to be one of those guys who, as I put it in my Adventures with Your Money, he would rather work twice as hard to steal 50 cents from you than do half the amount of work to earn an honest buck. For him, he equated honesty with weakness, and he found what he called, quote-unquote, straight people, meaning people who lived by the letter of the law, dull. And there's a lot of con men of that era. He figured out that he felt that it was his duty to fleece you and to separate you from your money, because if you were stupid enough to fall for some, or gullible enough to fall for some of his ploys, you know, if he didn't rip you off, somebody else was going to. It was almost a survival of the fittest, and these con men of that era had this credo that if you were a mark and you were a victim, or you were a sucker was the term that they used for you, you were there to be set up and taken down, and if they didn't do it, somebody else was going to.
Sure. One of the things that you talk about, and was touching on what we just did, but despite his criminal leanings, G.G. Rice was actually a high, intelligent businessman. He pioneered many marketing ideas, concepts that are still in use in centuries later. Celebrity endorsements, sex is a selling tool. I mean, it goes on and on.
Yeah, that's correct. I mean, you look back, you know, today we have some slick terms for these tactics that are used in marketing. We call it customer profiling, for example, today. George Graham Rice in 1915, 100 years ago, called it his sucker list. He was one of the first people that I've come across, that I have a record of in business, who in the early 1900s, when people were just getting telephones installed, if you had the financial means to have a telephone in your own house in 1901, when he first began as a racetrack tipster, when it rang and jangled, it was a thrill for the family. People ran to see who was calling, who was on the other end of the line. And if it was somebody like George Graham Rice, who had men crammed in a boiler room making these long-distance telephone calls to you, pitching an investment idea, you felt like you were singled out for this important sales pitch. And why else would a known stockbroker like George Graham Rice be calling you from New York if it wasn't important and worth your time and worth his time? So he pioneered telemarketing. He was a pioneer in customer profiling. And he also did something that we see every day in the newspaper. He pioneered outlandish publicity stunts to try and go along and just to draw attention to his sham stocks and securities that he sold. For example, he cooked up when the automobile was the hot new invention and he was selling mining stocks in California and Nevada, he came up with the idea of an auto race across Death Valley, which was, you know, to put it mildly, was treacherous in that day and age. It was taking your life in your own hands to try and get across Death Valley in a 1906 Pope Toledo automobile. He also staged what went on. He didn't know it was going, you know, as fate would have it, it became the longest boxing match in championship match in history. But he staged a boxing match in the roiling, broiling 115th Nevada desert solely for the purpose of drawing people to his mining town, Goldfield, Nevada, and to get his stocks on the front page of the New York Times. And he succeeded, and the boxing match was a big hit. And to this day, people remember the boxing match. They don't remember the stocks that he peddled, but certainly back in the day, he did, and he accomplished what he set out to do.
You know, when you really come down to it, and I'm not going to get political, left or right, doesn't matter, but one of the things that we look at, celebrity endorsements, outlandish publicity stunts, telemarketing, customer profiling, they do that politically every day, both sides.
It is done today, and it's so pervasive, it's become part of the fabric of our society here in America. And, you know, they, in my, you know, if George Graham Rice is a con artist, I'll give him at least some points that he was honest, and instead of calling it a customer profile database, he called it his sucker list. He called it what it was worth. So when the phone rings in your home and somebody's promising you a too-good-to-be-true proposition, like you just won 5 nights in the Bahamas for free, you'd better think twice about it in this day and age. It's not fundamentally very much different from what George Graham Rice was doing in 1915, 100 years ago.
You mean when I get an email that says, dear sir, not my name, dear sir, you are getting $550 million. It was donated to you from so-and-so. Just give me your bank account number. You know, as ridiculous as that sounds, it happens every day. TD, it goes on, and people still fall for it.
Yeah, in fact, Michael, you bring up something that I outlined and tried to trace the history of in my Adventures with Your Money, and that's the scam emails that we get today.
Yeah.
And they're ubiquitous. We learn, hopefully a lot of us learn just to hit the delete key and not look at them, but, you know, you send out 100,000 of them, you might have one or two people who bite on the scam, and that's all that needs to be done. But
it all takes,
That very scam, which today, it often takes the form of, I'll give you a for instance, a Nigerian prince has had his fortune wrongly taken from him. And to get it back, he needs to transfer it into your bank account. And for this help that you give him, he will share this, it's a non-existent fortune, he will share this with you as long as you send him your bank account number. Now, he'll clean out your bank account in 2 seconds if you're stupid enough to do that. But that is, people attribute that to, well, it's new, it's the internet, it's the way that crooks operate these days. That is actually a variation of something called the Spanish prisoner scam, which traces back to the 16th century when people would send letters across the ocean on a boat, and the rook back then was, I am a prisoner being held in Spain. I'm being held captive against my will. I have a substantial reward that my people are offering for me. If you will send me some money to get the program kickstarted, I will reward you with gold and doubloons, and I will let you share in this wealth once I am finally freed. It's not new. It happened as far back as the 1500s. It's just that it's being refurbished and retrofitted to fit the times today, and the means are the internet today.
No, but realistically, though, the one that I love the most, and I've gotten this two or three times, it's from somebody I know, and they're stuck at a hotel in France and England and it's somewhere, and they lost their wallet, they lost their credit cards, and please send them money to get home with. You know, and then you call the people and you say, what's going on? And they have no idea. But they really get people's names, and they really know how to do what they're doing, all stemming from what you're talking about. And I really believe if you read the book, you get a good look at what goes on in today's world, and it'll make you stop and think before you react or respond to something.
I would hope it would, but, you know, as people who have studied con artistry throughout the years seem to hammer home this point, and it doesn't always resonate with some of us in the general public, that con artistry is cyclical. The basic scams might change and might be refurbished with the time, but the basic core fundamental methodology that con artistry works off of is con artists are trained, and this is a skill that's much like magicians, it was passed down in George Graham Rice's day only from one con artist to another. They weren't about to let the general public in on their tricks, but
sure.
Con artists were trained to approach strangers very casually, but they had already studied them, perhaps in a Pullman car on a train, and they were trained to, within the first five minutes of conversation, to figure out exactly how much money you had, what line of work you were in, and how averse to risk you were. And the thing that they were gunning for was to see if you would be complicit in some sort of illicit behavior. Because one of the maxims of con artistmen is you can't con an honest mark. A mark is a term for a victim. And if they found out within the first few minutes of talking to you that you were fairly fundamentally honest, they would leave you alone and move on to the next victim. However, if they found out that you maybe had a touch of larceny in your heart, they would get right to the heart of that, and they would stoke that touch of larceny to fully engaged and fully enraged lust for money. And they didn't notice in George Graham Rice's day, but psychologists have since dubbed that moral licensing. It's the ability that, Michael, if I got on terms, friendly terms with you, and I found out that you might want to make a little bit of extra money on the side doing something illegal or by helping me out doing something illegal, I would laugh at
you. You got me,
you.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
no, absolutely, no question about it.
Yeah. And another thing that con artists would try to do was, you know, you and I might, let's say you meet somebody at a cocktail party or at a gathering and they're kind of a know-it-all or a braggart, you and I might just say, well, geez, I'm gonna switch off and go talk to somebody else. But a con artist sought those people out, because the people who think they know it all, who think they're smarter than the rest of society, are the ones that are the ripest pickings for con artists. And that's a
sure.
guy like George Graham Rice would zero in on them.
So, by the way, and there's tons of people like that out there today. They open themselves up in public to hide what they don't know, and the con artist is going to see beyond that. The con artists are sharp. There's no question about this. And, you know, obviously there's no college education for a con artist that's learned on the street, but it's all the same thing, and it's traveled all the way up to the future and will always be here. But the key is I lost the word I wanted to use, but the
human nature.
The landmarks change, okay? But it's always the same thing. We live in a different culture. We live in a different world. We think differently. But at the same time, those very things that we're talking about here are alive, and they will stay alive.
I would agree with you. I mean, if you walk down the street in New York City, you're going to see in certain neighborhoods, although they've tried to sanitize it to some degree, people playing three-card Monty or the shell game. And that's not new. That didn't just start happening over the weekend. I mean, that has been going on for hundreds of years. And I can recall, as, you know, I'm in my late 40s, but as a kid, I can recall going to New York City, to Manhattan, with a college buddy, a kid who was really, really smart and otherwise book smart. But he got there, and he was drawn in by the fascination of the shell game or the three-card Monty. And he thought he was fundamentally smarter than the guy on the street trying to pull off this con. He knew where the shell was, and he was going to prove to that guy and win some money that he was right. And, of course, we all know it's a rigged game. And I tried to grab my buddy away from there, and you could see all of the lines of defense that con artists have, even at that very basic level. The shell game is not a very intricate con, But there were intricate things that I could see going on that my friend could not see. For example, when I started to take him by the arm and pull him away, another gentleman who was pretending to be one of the players, but he was really part of the con, boxed me out and pushed me away. And then when my friend finally got enraged that he had lost $300 to some guy in the street and was going to make a fuss of it, what did the guy do? He knocked his own game over. He said, "The police are coming. We all have to leave." And everybody scattered, and my friend was without his money, and that's how it happens. Smart people get suckered in, because one of the hallmarks of con artistry is they use your own intelligence against you. If you think you're going to outwit the con artist, he's going to let you have a go at it, and guess what? You're not going to win.
Right. No question about it, and there is no question about it. By the way, TD, we could talk about this all night, but we are just starting to run out of time. So let me ask you this. Website, we can find you and your books.
You can check out tdthornton.net, and the book is My Adventures with Your Money, George Graham Rice and the Golden Age of the Con Artist. It's available online and in ebook form on Amazon, iTunes, but I would hope you might support your local independent bookseller. They've been good to me, and I want to try and be good to them. My Adventures with Your Money just came out this week.
Wonderful. And somebody misses it, it's still up on our website, and it'll be there. And thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you, Michael. Guard your wallet.
Take care. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye-bye.
Stay with us. We're going to be back with Kerry Heaps. Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to The Michael Dresser Show. Kerry Heaps with us, the publisher of Strictly Marketing Magazine and the host of Strictly Marketing Talk Radio. We're going to talk about the top five marketing tips to boost your sales effort. Both media outlets are dedicated to providing excellent marketing advice from professionals nationwide. Kerry's passion is to help other business owners and their marketing efforts to continue their dream entrepreneurship. Kerry's recently launched an online community for women in marketing to assist women business owners and marketing executives in making online connections and increasing their visibility. Kerry, hi, welcome to the show.
Thank you, Michael. I'm so excited to be here with you today.
Oh, and thank you so much for being here. You know, and especially your topic, because in today's world, we have so many people starting businesses. They go into business. They've got these wonderful ideas, but then they come up with that word, the M word, marketing. That's not something that people automatically know how to do. Where do you go? What's that first step that somebody needs to take when they get into business? They're all ready to go, but they've got to be able to let the public know they're there.
Well, there's a couple of things that they need to do. I would say that the very first step that they need to take is, you know, obviously getting prepared. You know, if you have a product or a service, you are supposed to be the expert in your industry. So make sure that everything that you have available to the public moving forward, you have a system in place. You have everything set up. The reason I say that's so important is because I find that a lot of people, they're just not prepared. They have nothing prepared, whether it's material, marketing material, or they don't have business cards yet. There's always something that's kind of hindering them from moving forward. And I think fear plays into that just a little bit.
Sure.
You know, just because they're really excited about what they're doing, they're very, very good at it, but they don't know, they're like, okay, I have to go out and I have to start networking, or I have to start advertising, or I need to get, you know, all of my brochures together or print up business cards. And because it is such a broad area, I think a lot of people, there's fear there. And some people will say, hey, you need to have a Facebook fan page, you need to have a Twitter page, you need to have a website, you got to have a blog. There's all these different things that that are a part of marketing now. And I think we live in an age now where there's so much information thrown at us and there's so many different ways to distribute it. It can become overwhelming.
Absolutely. So, you know, Carrie, there's only one reason somebody is frightened, one reason and one reason only. Fear comes from the unknown. Now, if I come to you and you're holding me by the hand and you're taking me step by step through the process of what to do, all of a sudden the unknown becomes the known and the fear goes away.
Exactly. And, you know, and I guess my, to kind of go back to your question, you know, with being prepared, know as well that you're not going to have everything done prior to, you know, launching your business. It just doesn't work that way. You're going to have to add to it. You're going to have to change things. You know, we just recently launched what you were talking about, Strictly Women in Marketing, an online community. We just launched that on Tuesday, and we're still making, you know, some upgrades and some additions to the site because there's just little things that we forgot or, you know, that we didn't think about that people have already asked us about, and, you know, we've had to make some changes. So don't be afraid to, you know, kind of adjusted as you go along.
You know what I have found in business over the years? Man or woman. And the end result, it really doesn't matter, because when you start, obviously you're a certain gender. But when you get into it and you're successful, you leave the gender behind you and you are that person that has that offering that's going to benefit the people that you're dealing with.
Absolutely. And I couldn't agree more. You know, the reason that we kind of launched this new online community specifically for women, and of course men are welcome to join. We've been encouraging as many men who are in the marketing industry to, you know, to go ahead and join and create a profile and be a part of the community, possibly be a mentor to a woman in business or even to some of the women that are in college that are looking for a mentor in the marketing industry. And part of the reason we created that is I, like you, Michael, I have a show called Strictly Marketing. You know, and we have a magazine called Strictly Marketing where we only cover marketing topics. And one of the things that I found to be very, I guess, saddening is the best emotion I can associate this to, is that we would submit queries. We send them out, you know, on a monthly basis. And specifically for our feature interview, who's going to be the feature interview centered around that publication, and that person's going to be, you know, the feature of the publication. They're on the front of the magazine. They're promoted first and foremost. And I really have found since I launched the magazine that our ratio for, you know, women to men, for every, you know, 10 submissions that we have for, you know, that are coming in for the feature interview, one of those would be a woman. And the rest for men. And I thought, you know, that's really, it really saddens me because I find that, you know, women, there's so many great women entrepreneurs and CEOs out there. And, you know, why aren't they making that effort to, you know, to go out there to be featured? And I found the same thing with the talk radio program as well. We always had more men that were submitting their information rather than women. And I had spoken with a few other people that host shows and have blogs and different publications, and they, you know, mentioned the same thing, that their numbers are low. And I'm really hoping that with this community we can kind of change that and really put some more women out at the forefront. Granted that they do, you know, they're providing great content and valuable content for the readers or listenership.
You got one word that causes all of that, and the word, Carrie, is judgment, the frightened to death of judgment. And you don't have to be a woman to do that, men, women, et cetera. If you look at the amount of women that come on this show, I would venture to guess they outnumber the men for whatever reason. But the point of contention is it's that unknown of what they're walking into, they, the human being, the business person. And if they're not comfortable with it and they're afraid of the judgments of what somebody's going to say, think, or et cetera, that stops them. And the idea is just bite your tongue, just go do it.
And I couldn't agree more. And, you know, and I've had the exact same thing happen. You know, putting yourself out there, you're going to have people who will judge you. Some of it's positive, some of it's negative, but it's all part of being a business owner. You just have to learn to deal with it.
Let me tell you what I've learned over the years about that particular subject. When somebody thinks something of you, like you, dislike you, whatever the case may be, Carrie, it has nothing to do with you. They're projecting themselves. And when we start to get that, all of a sudden those judgments that we were afraid of have nothing to do with who we are, why we are. There are people out there who are jealous of what we do. They may not like us because they don't think they could do what we can do. I mean, the list goes on and on. But for the most part, when you deal with judgments and the rest of it, the world is nothing more than this big mirror, and you see yourself. And what you don't like in somebody else is what you don't like in yourself. And once somebody gets that, all of a sudden there's a power inside of them that they can experience that they've never felt before.
Right. I couldn't agree more, and you're definitely right on the money. So, I'm glad that you shared that with everyone as well.
Yeah, because that's really when it comes down. Here, try this out. I'll give you a great example. You ready?
Sure.
Here it goes. Okay. Ask me if I'm good looking. Go ahead, ask me.
Michael, are you good looking?
Funny you should ask that question. Absolutely. And if you don't think so, somebody else will. See, there's the key. Carrie, if I had the ability to, if I had five women standing in front of me right now, and I had the ability to get behind each one and look through their eyes and see me, I'd see a gorgeous Michael, I'd see a homely Michael, I'd see an okay Michael, and the ones that thought I was homely or whatever, there is nothing I can do to make them think any different. So I go to the ones who think I'm gorgeous. Same thing in business.
Absolutely. And you're right. You're absolutely right.
Yeah. Now, when we come down to it, five marketing tips to boost your sales effort. Let me ask you this question. Do most people know what they're selling?
I would say half and half.
Okay.
You know, my experience has been, with the different clients that we have worked with over the years, it's about half and half. Some of them have to go back and really look at their process, look at what they're offering, look at what they're doing first, because they're just not ready to take the next step. And then the other half are.
Yeah. Because
and
when you really,
really
come down to it, it's not the benefit that we sell. It's the benefit of the benefit, meaning I go into a gym, and I've worked out all my life, but I go into a gym and they've got this feature, which is a machine, and the benefit is I get a big bicep. Well, don't sell me the machine. Don't sell me the bicep. Ask me why I want the big bicep. Well, I want to look good out on the beach. Sell me the beach. And I think that in and of itself is where that one step, that one extra step taken, finding out what the people want, why they want the product, the service, whatever, what they want it for, what's it going to do for them, how it's going to look once they get it, all of a sudden the world turns around.
Absolutely, and it's funny that you bring up an example of a gym because we talk about the top five tips that I was going to share. One of the first ones, Michael, is about creating a marketing activity calendar. And that's actually not mine. I have to credit Ken Jennings. He was someone who was on our publication earlier this year. And that's one of the things that he really talked about in depth was creating a marketing activity calendar. And you look at a gym owner, there's going to be certain times of the year that, you look around the holidays, the gym's pretty much empty because people are, traveling, they're enjoying the holiday season. And they still need to get out there and do certain marketing activities when the gym isn't full. And then they need to kind of switch it a little bit and still do some marketing activities during their peak times for, January, for, just before summer, like you were talking about, getting into bikini shape
get to
or
the beach.
Shape. So, creating a marketing calendar is very important. And, you need to know, what you're selling before you can put something like that together. And it certainly doesn't have to be anything fancy. I have a marketing calendar, and it's just a calendar thing that I bought from, from a dollar store. So, just so we know when we're doing certain things and for which business we're doing it for. So creating a marketing calendar is, first and foremost. The second thing I would tell people is, you know, when you're promoting your business, you know, whether it's online, in person, or, you know, you're going out there and you're doing networking, you need to do a little bit of everything. I find anymore, I see some people who will talk about, you know, oh, well, all I do is I promote my business on Twitter. And if that's working for you, great. But the majority of the people I have found, you know, they're doing a little bit of social media. They're doing a little bit of networking. You know, they have a little bit of everything going on. You know, they might be doing some networking networking events in person or doing some cold calling. But have certain activities lined up based on what you do, how
sure.
you're reaching your target market, because every business is different, whether you're in direct sales or if you are in insurance sales or if you're trying to go out there and you're trying to meet with, you know, CEOs, CFOs of the company. So everything is different. The third thing I would tell people is, you know, what we're doing right now, Michael, get in the media. You need to get out there. Help establish yourself as an expert. You need to, you know, if you're really an expert at what you do, show it. You know, write for a blog, write for a magazine. Have, you know, different places where you're contributing content. Do interviews, whether they're podcasts or if you're doing an interview with a radio station in the town where you live or where you work. You need to have a certain amount of media exposure and create a press page for your website. So when people visit your page, they can go on there. They can click on those links. They can listen to your interview. They can listen to your podcast, or they can, you know, read that article that you wrote 2 years ago. That helps, you know, with your marketing efforts. It gets your name out there, and that's it's so important to be able to do that. And I would say for number
One of the things also to add to that is it all has to do with word-of-mouth marketing, because it comes down to that. And that's really where the key is. Look at social media. Hundreds of millions of people. But what drives it? Somebody told somebody.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. So, you know, that it's just very important. And I have some people that they're like, oh, I don't know that I want to do that. And I said, look, if you're not sure if you can handle it, start out slow. Write some articles. You know, you should be able to write about what you specialize in. And if you can't, you need to regroup and think about your business. Do you really need to be there? So writing would be first. The second thing would be, you know, segue into radio interviews. And then lastly, look at video interviews, possibly getting featured on a local station, because, you know, that's a different topic. But, you know,
sure.
Start out slowly. Start out with what you know, work your way into it. But having a press section and getting coverage however you can, it's so important. And the last step I would say that is the most important, it's follow-up. You need to create a follow-up process for your business. And believe it or not, all of the marketing efforts that you do, no matter how many networking events you attend, no matter how much inbound marketing calls that you get or social media tweets that you do, if you are reaching out to people, if you're meeting with them or they're meeting with you, they're calling you, it's all done in vain if you don't follow up. I see so many people who miss out on a lot of opportunities just because of lack of follow-up. So you need to have some type of follow-up system. And again, it doesn't have to be anything fancy. You know, it can be something very simple. You can get something high-tech with Salesforce, you know, where you have constant reminders. But you need to have a follow-up process. And I'll share a very quick story about my own business.
Please.
One of the biggest clients that I have right now, it took me 2 years of follow-up before they brought me on board as a vendor, you know, where they're a client of mine now. So it took me 2 years. And most people, you know, they'll ask me, well, how many phone calls did you actually do? Well, dialing their telephone number was in the hundreds, obviously. How many conversations did I have with them during that, you know, two-year time period? Probably about 20. And it would really just be where I would call in, follow up, you know, just wanted to check in with you, how are things going? I knew what their process was, what they were trying to accomplish. And anytime I would find things that I, you know, articles or interviews that I felt would help them with their process, I would email it to them or give them a call and say, hey, I found something online. Would you like to take a look at it? How are things going? How, you know, and they always appreciated that. And I would always make sure that I told them at the end of the phone call, hey, look, I know you still said that it could be a few more months out. Is it okay if I reach out, you know, at the end of the year? Absolutely. You know, that's totally fine. And I reached out at the end of the year. And that ultimately, you know, when they brought me on board, they said, this is the reason why we chose you, is because when you told us you were going to call back, you did it. So be a person of your word, have a follow-up process. Everything that you're doing to market your business, if you don't have some type of follow-up process in place, it's really going to be a waste of time, you know, doing any of it.
No, absolutely, no question about it, because when it really comes down to it, a business and the people those businesses hire, a successful business is a family, period, end. You know, you grow up and your mom and dad model a particular way of having a family. You're accepted, you're acknowledged, et cetera. And if that's the way it is, this is what you look for. And when you get out into the world, whether you're an entrepreneur or you're working for somebody, whatever it is, this is what unconsciously you look for. And you'll find the successful businesses today, it's not vice president and president, it's mom and dad.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And that, absolutely, in and of itself, I think, what makes it successful. Mm-hmm. And that's what we look for.
Right. And, you know, and again, I going back to the follow-up portion, it can be life or death of the business, you know, of your business.
Sure.
So, you know, make sure that you have some type of process set up. So those are some tips that I still use in my business, and hopefully they'll also be of use to the people who are tuning in as well.
Yeah. Oh, Carrie, that's where I was going with that. You keep calling, you care.
Mm-hmm.
They're acknowledged. They're there. You care about them. And that's why I was talking about family. You know,
mm-hmm.
you belong part of it, even
yes,
if it takes
and,
you 2 years.
Yeah, and sometimes, you know, you have to kind of prove yourself. And you know, like I said, if somebody's not ready, you know, there are certain things with business that you can't, you know, you look at an employment agency. If I have no job openings, I can't just create one. You know, you have to kind of wait till I have an opening and you know, keep me – make sure that you are forefront in my mind, and the way that you do that is you continually follow up. And I think it does, it really does show that you care, that you want to be a part of their extended family, so to speak.
But that's really what it comes down to. If they're bringing you in, your extended family, you are part
mm-hmm.
of what they represent and what they're putting out to the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it's getting
absolutely.
Very interesting today, because it's becoming more and more technical. It's becoming less and less like it used to be, and we're going into a kind of a different marketing world that we saw before with the internet and so on and so forth. 5, 6, 7 years ago, you could say, Michael, you think you know everything? I would have said, of course not. You asked me that today, my answer is absolutely I do. Give me, you know, I'll go to Google.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, what don't you know anymore?
Well, yeah, and I will say, too, with that, it's just like I find there's a lot of experts out there that do try to take a simple process and make it complicated, you know,
sure.
And I think that's not a good thing to do. There's just no reason to complicate it, and I find, too, even with my own business, a lot of times it's just picking up the phone and calling them. You can email them all day long or send them tweets on Twitter. If they don't see that or if it goes to their junk file, I don't count that as follow-up. You know, pick up the phone. Find out what's going on. You know, they could be out of the office. They could be sick. They could be on vacation. They could not be with the company anymore. You know, there's a lot of turnover these days, so more so than what it was 10 years ago. So, you know, you never know.
Total agreement. Carrie, we're just about out of time, so let me ask you this. Website we can find you at, find the programs, and get a hold of you.
Okay, great. Definitely for the magazine, it's strictlymarketingmagazine.com. And then the website that we just launched for our online community, it's a little bit long right now, and we're looking at shortening that. We just launched it on Tuesday, but it's strictlywomeninmarketing.wildapricot.org, O-R-G. And we have some great promotions that we're doing with that particular site. When you go there, you can sign up and get our top 5 tips to gaining more media coverage. It's a free download, so I encourage everyone who is able to go ahead and go there and sign up, because men can join as well. So we would love to have you join us online.
There you go. There's your next marketing. How to become a top apricot.
Absolutely. It's
I love it. Okay.
Great,
hey, by
software.
The way, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure and honor to be on the show. I really appreciate spending some time with you today.
Oh, my pleasure, too. Take care. Good night.
Thank you.
Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to The Michael Dresser Show. Tonette living with us, and she's the author of Nothing Left Over, A Plain and Simple Life. Born in London, had a long and distinguished career at Alfred Knopf. In 1989, she founded Bell Tower, where she published 70 books, nourished the soul, illuminated the mind, and spoke directly to the heart. Her second book, Caught in the Act, Reflections on Being, Knowing, and Doing, was published in 2004, and after 50 years in publishing, Tonette abandoned editorial work and devotes herself to East Asian brush painting, where she taught at the Educational Alliance for 4 years, and now teaches on the Upper West Side of New York. And let's say, Tonette, I welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. It's lovely to be with you.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. Nothing Left Over, A Plain and a Simple Life. I wonder how many people would love to be able to say that. The title,
just do things as directly as possible and as soon
yes.
as possible.
Now, when you say nothing left over, does this reflect your life, or did you come to this roadmap or this road mark somewhere in your life where you decided that this is the way life should be?
I was brought up during the Second World War in London, and everything was very scarce. So we had to make do with very little. And when I came to this country in 1964, I was very taken aback because the servings in restaurants were so big and there was so much of everything. And I guess I've never really taken to the American way of life, even though this is 51 years later.
Yeah.
I like small portions of life in any given moment, but I like to enjoy it to the full.
No question about it. Now, the book in and of itself, what is the essence there? What was it that you wanted to say to that public out there?
I feel that I've already just said it in some ways, but I was asked to write this book, and the publisher even had the title, and I said, what do you mean by nothing left over? And he said, well, this would be a book about living a simple life, such as when you boil a tea kettle, you just put in enough water for one person. And I said, of course, doesn't everybody? And he said, no. And I said, well, they're wasting time, money, energy, and water. And he laughed. But that's really the way I look at everything. What is the most simple way to deal with whatever is in front of me and embrace it and move on to the next thing, and not just with boiling water?
You know, one of the things that you say, and I completely 3,000% agree, that in the book you say whatever is in front of you is your teacher.
Yes.
That it's got to be. No matter what it is, we're put on this planet to learn, and every time you turn around, you're learning something new. If you get that big lesson that you're supposed to learn, well, guess what you get? Another lesson to learn. So it's constant, isn't it?
Yes. I mean, there are wonderful things and there are dreadful things, but you don't have any choice, really. You can't opt out. Not if you stay in this life.
No, but not if you stay in. But the dreadful things, those are all lessons also. And
yes.
if you're able to move through them, able to see what's behind them, what's causing it, and not from anything external, from inside yourself, you grow.
Yes, and I remember once my son said to me, you can always learn something from everything, even if it's something he was going to go to a film of Hiawatha, and I couldn't believe that a teenager would do that. He was a serious film student. I said, why would you want to do that? You're not a child anymore. He said, I can learn a lot from going to a film, even if what I learn is how not to do it.
Yeah. But that's really the key. There are people over the years that I've interviewed who have lost family, lost a husband, lost a wife, lost children. And at the time, it was horrible. But what they did with it, they either started classes, they wrote books, and they created a legacy so it would pass that forward to those people who were going through that to help them to ease it, to take a look at things before they happen, to anticipate. And all of a sudden, those very horrible things that happened turned into something very good. Not that we want them to happen, but you've got to take a look at what's going on, why it's going on, and what you can do with it.
It's the lemonade syndrome, right?
If you
have lemons, make lemonade.
Yeah, absolutely. No question about it. And I like one of your rules also is called do it now.
Yes.
Why wait? And we do stall, don't we?
Yes, and it's if you could spell wait the other way, W-E-I-G-H-T-E, it's such, if you put things off, it's a real physical and emotional drag. They weigh you down. But doing things in the moment means that you don't get pulled down in that way.
And one other thing that ties to this is one of the principles that you live by is do and say nothing unnecessary. And a practical level, how does that work?
For instance, if I'm going to clean the bathroom, I shouldn't get distracted along the way by seeing something else that needs to be done. So I have in mind to clean the bathroom, and that is what I should give my full attention to. We do tend to get distracted by what we see out of the corner of our eye, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. No question about it. You know, and I think that's a big problem for a lot of people. They end up never getting anything done because the distraction leads to another distraction, which leads to another distraction.
Yes. And then there are those people who make lists. I used to make lists. But then I realized that was also a distraction because while I was writing things down, I could start doing the first thing.
Oh, absolutely. By the way, I want to jump on to something else which I think is extremely important, and it's something that you say that the greatest gift that you can give to anybody is your attention, and I totally and completely 3,000% agree with that. People love acknowledgement.
Yes. So even if it's a person or if it's the bathroom or whatever it is or whoever it is, one shouldn't hold back, because you've only got one chance in that moment for being present to whatever or whoever it is.
Yeah.
And then that moment is gone.
Yeah, you know, that's interesting, too. We don't think about that. It's the future, and then all of a sudden it wasn't. It's the past. If you blink your eye, it's over with. Once you've lived it, it's there, and it's there so fast that it's already over with, and most of us don't even get that. And it's very hard to stay in the now for most people.
Yes. Yes, they're either looking back like Mrs. Lott or looking forward. Right? But there's only now, because one is past and one may not come.
Not true. Now, by the way, when you decided to write the book, this book, when it came right down to it, you know, nothing left over, a plain and simple life. What actually brought you to writing the book? What made you decide to put all of these thoughts to pen?
I was having dinner one night with a publishing friend at Penguin Putnam, and I told him that I was going to quit my job at age 62 on the day that my son started work. And because I felt I'd worked too hard my entire life and hadn't learned to play, and that I wanted to learn how to play. And he immediately asked me if I would write a book for him called Nothing Left Over. And I said, well, I don't know that I can write a book. I've never even thought about it. I said, let me think about it and get back to you. And he said, no, I want an answer right now.
Good for him.
I said, well, you know, I really have to think if I have enough to say. And so it took me about 2 days to digest this, and then I got in touch with him. In fact, I was in a cab with a friend in another part of town, and I happened to see him on the sidewalk. So I said to the cab driver, stop, let me out, and I ran after him. And I said, the answer is yes. And you know, I didn't start with a plan. I just began to type. And I had one, I give this advice sometimes to authors when they're having difficulty writing, that they could try what I tried. It just happened that way. I started with a document, and I just kept typing, and every morning I would look at what was in that document, and I began to see themes in there. So I'd pull out everything that seemed to be circling around the same theme and put it in a new document and give it a title. And those titles, which are the principles that I live by, are the chapter titles. And at the end, when I felt that I'd removed everything from that document, I did have nothing left over, and I had a book, or a manuscript at that point.
You know, there's a question I've asked over the years many, many times to many, many different guests, and it's, you know, whether your subject matter is fact, fun, fiction, fantasy, whatever the case may be, there comes that part in the writing when there's something about yourself you discover that you weren't aware of. Where was that for you in the writing?
I don't know if there was one moment, but the writing of it was very interesting because, you know, one never really analyzes. I had never analyzed what was inside me and how I thought and how I behaved. And this was the first time I was living an examined life. That's how it felt.
Yeah.
So it was very revealing when I wrote down how I lived and how I thought and how I felt. I was always dealing with the present moment and hadn't thought about my thoughts. I really hadn't. So it was a revelation.
So it's interesting when you put it down on paper, it's like you can step away from yourself, because it really doesn't matter what the subject matter is. We're all writing about ourselves.
Yes.
Yeah,
because
how we project out to the world.
Yes, exactly. We're writing about the way we see things, and everybody sees things differently because they're standing in a different place on the globe. So everybody has got a different viewpoint. Nobody is standing where I'm standing.
Yeah, and that's what's interesting also, especially when you're writing, if you're going to be a talk show host, whatever the case may be. And I learned this years ago. When I started connecting with people is when I stopped talking to myself. I went beyond my own experiences. I allowed people to be who they were, and I became them while I was talking to them.
That's fascinating. Yes.
Yeah, and you have to really be able to do that, because you'll find in talking to most people, if you really listen to what they're saying, they're talking about themselves, and I don't care what the subject matter is, it's still about them, and that's really where the key is. But it's something that comes with time, with age.
And to go back to what we started out talking about, that's giving your attention to the other person, your full attention.
Absolutely. What an absolutely wonderful gift that is. Think about a kid, you know, a child growing up, 4 or 5-year-old, 6-year-old. What's the best thing you can give them? Not a toy. Your attention. What do they look for? Your attention. And I think that's exactly what happens if a kid gets into trouble. They're getting into trouble because they're not getting attention at home. So they get attention doing something that's not real acceptable.
And I remember that when my ex-husband was dying, I asked Ramdas, I had edited two or three of his books, and mm-hmm. I asked him what I could do, because I had all my loved ones had always died off stage. I had not been present, and this was the first time that I thought I might be there at the last moment. And he said something very similar to what we're talking about. He said, give him your full attention, and if possible, coordinate your breathing with his. That is the best thing you can do for him. I actually was not there at the moment that he died, but it was very helpful along the way.
Wait. Yes, you were.
What?
I said, yes, you were. You were there.
I was there, yes.
Not
I
necessarily
wasn't there.
Physically, but you were there.
I wasn't there physically because I needed to come home.
No, right.
My
you weren't there
was
physically, but you
school.
Were there.
Yes. Yes, I was there. Yes.
Yeah. I mean, that's really what it comes down to. And attention is such an important thing. Do you realize the kids that would not be in trouble now, the relationships that wouldn't break up if somebody just gave somebody attention?
Yes.
Yeah. Got it.
As you're, particularly with kids, right.
Oh, sure. Now, we're starting to run out of time, so let me ask you this. Website we can find you at and get the book.
Okay. Luckily, nobody else had claimed the name ToinetteLippi.com, so this is how it's spelled.
I didn't know how to pronounce your name in front
right.
of me. I do now.
It's like Marie Antoinette, but without the Marie Anne. So it's...
I got it.
T for Tom, OINETTE, L for London, I, double P for Peter, E for Edward.com. And you can find information about my books, my paintings, the cards, anything, all kinds of stuff, and a lot about the books that I've edited.
Wonderful. And by the way, if somebody misses your website right now, it's up on ours and it'll stay there. And I want
Perfect.
To thank you so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you, too. It was lovely.
Oh, my pleasure. Take care.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Welcome back. I'm Michael. You're listening to The Michael Dresser Show. Zach Johnson with us. We're going to talk about making money online. He's one of the widely respected leaders in the blogging and internet marketing communities through his popular blogs, bloggingtips.com and zachjohnson.com. He's helped thousands of readers grow their brands and make money online. Self-taught entrepreneur, Zach's been making money online for over 15 years and has been involved in nearly every facet of internet marketing while also finding great success in the world of blogging. 2007, Zach launched his blog at zachjohnson.com, which is focused on his successes and failures, case studies, industry news, and guides on how to make money online. And let us say, Zach, hi, welcome to the show.
Hey, Michael, how's it going? It's so great to hear that you're doing well, and thanks for having me back on the show.
Oh, my pleasure. Absolutely my pleasure. You know, when it comes down to it, we take a look at online. We look at the internet. If I have you on every 6 months, I'll bet any amount of money there's going to be some kind of a change and some kind of a twist and something different to do on the internet to make money.
Oh, definitely. And it's funny because I first started making money online back in 1995, and to actually talk to people today about how they're making money online and to go back and talk about what it used to be like, it's so funny because most people don't even have like a realization, because today it's easy to create a website or a blog. You just install WordPress. But back in the 90s and early 2000s, you actually had to create an HTML site. You would use a graphics program. Then you would have FTP to actually pull all together and upload it to the internet. So today it's so much easier for people to actually find different ways to make money online, but not just make money, but actually get started without needing to know all the technical know-how.
Now, one of the keys, and I want to use the words, and let's get into this because it's very important, affiliate marketing, very important in making money online.
Yeah, affiliate marketing is great. It's one of the first ways I made money online. And the best way to explain it is, let's say you work inside of a store like Sears or something, and basically you're waiting for customers to come in, and then they say, okay, I'm going to buy this, and you help them out, and then you kind of get a little commission from it, and that's how it works online. But it's even cooler because you don't need to work in a retail location. You just need to get people to your website, and you can join an affiliate program for any website like Amazon.com. So if you read a book, you write about it on your site and say, this book was great, if you want to get it, click here. Anybody that goes to your website, clicks on that link, then orders from Amazon.com, you'll get a commission, and then you'll get a check at the end of the month.
Oh, okay. So you could do that with many, many different people.
Yeah, it's great because affiliate marketing, it really started in the mid-90s when Amazon launched it. And since then, almost every company and brand in the world today has some form of affiliate program. And there's affiliate networks out there. ShareASell.com is one of them. And you can join this network and then gain access to thousands of different affiliate programs. And no matter what the focus is for your website or your blog, you can find relevant topics or products or services related to the topics you write about. And then whenever somebody either fills out a form to sign up for a credit card or purchases something or even just a generic lead, you could be earning commission off that and never having to hold any inventory, actually talking with the customer, or even processing the credit card. All you need to do is be able to find the people that are interested in offers and then redirect them over to the advertiser using your affiliate link.
Well, now let's talk about creating a blog, how to start a blog. Now, when we hear the word blog, the first thing in our minds are, Zach, it's okay, you write something. But a blog is more than just writing something, isn't it?
Yeah, definitely. And blogging's been around for a few years now. But the big difference between blogging and back in the early days was websites were a one-way conversation. It was just you write content, people come in to read it. But now with the introduction of WordPress, which powers more than 50% of the sites on the internet today, pretty much, people can actually leave comments, they can share it on their social media, and they can actually engage with the person who owns the website. So it's easy for anyone to get started with a blog of their own. They can start one for free at WordPress.com. or actually start up their own domain and hosting and install a version of the free software from WordPress.org. It's very simple. You don't need to touch any lines of code or anything. Then you just really start writing content and posting it to your site. So if you know how to use a program like Microsoft Word, then you're easily going to be able to blog in no time. And whether you want to just blog for a passion or creating business, it's all about really understanding how to put it together. And there's different ways to go about it if you actually want to build a business out of it and make money. So you can talk about that or go a different direction if you like.
Okay, we'll get into that, but I want to touch on this for a moment. What if you don't want to go into business? What if you just want to do it for fun?
Yeah, so starting a blog for fun is a great way to really just figure out what it's all about. And the cool thing is a lot of people that started a blog for fun actually turned it into a business later on. A good example of this is PerezHilton.com. He just really wanted to be in that world of celebrity, and he was a celebrity columnist for another organization, and he ended up starting doing this stuff on his own, and now he's making over six figures a year, actually per month now with his site, and advertisers are paying like $45,000 a month just to have banners on his thing. So it's great to see how things go over time, and when you are starting a blog just for passion, you can put whatever you want out there about it. You can actually build a blog with your name as the domain name and just have your own presence online so that when people do search for you online, you're actually going to be in control of what appears at the top of the search results because it's likely going to rank your website. And that's a good example of what I've done with ZachJohnson.com. And, of course, your site ranks well for your name as well. So that's another great way to use blogging.
Now, by the way, the right niche for a blog, how do you find that right place for it?
Yeah, so if you want to start a blog to make money, it definitely is all about the niche market. You don't want to go wide scale. Instead, you want to go as niche as possible because there's over 300 million blogs in the world today. And if you want to compete, you really have to really get down and find who's looking for something. You want to be able to provide the most value, and you want to focus only on that topic. So if somebody goes to the search results and types in how to jump higher because they want to jump higher for volleyball or basketball, if you create a site that's simply dedicated to that and provide them with all the answers they need, that site's going to get an audience. They're ready to take action. You might be able to refer them to different PDF guides that they can earn a commission on. Or other websites and sports and health-related sites might actually link to your site by being a resource. So the more focused you can be on your blog, the better off you're going to be.
Now, by the way, the blog in and of itself is usually something that you have expertise in. Now, when somebody decides to write a blog, is that normally the subject matter that they deal with?
In most cases it is, especially if it's just a passion project or something that they have as a hobby, and they actually learn more about it over time. I also see that a lot of people start a blog about how to make money online, and they actually document their journey. So when they start off, they don't really know how to make money online. Then they start writing new blog posts about, today I figured out how to create my own ad campaign, and then maybe the next post would be whether they're making a profit or a loss. So whether they're an expert or not, they're definitely going to become better at whatever it is because they're going to be learning along the way. They're going to be looking at the competition. They're going to be compiling the best resources out there. And a lot of times people do create blogs, and really 6 to 12 months down the road, they're not really where they are expected because the blog took off in a different direction, whether it's making them be an expert or it's actually making them some money in the process.
Well, you know, Zach, one other thing, too, I think is very important, that getting that – building a brand from the blog, branding yourself, causing that certain something that when people hear it, they know that it's you they're talking about. How do you develop that?
Yeah, so it's all about putting yourself out there. As I mentioned, I started making money online in 1995, but it wasn't until 2007 that I really decided I wanted to become a brand of my own so that no matter what happened with the different brands I was working with online, I would always be able to fall back on myself and have that brand. So I created ZachJohnson.com, used my name, talk about affiliate marketing, how to make money online, blogging, everything you could think of. And then I also write on other websites. I have my own podcast. I'm appearing on your podcast. So it's all about getting your name out there, having people listen, telling their friends about it, maybe they're referencing it in their articles. It's all about continually just providing the best value, looking at the competition, how to do it better than them, and putting yourself out there and making yourself available. So the more you do that, the more your brand is going to get out there, be more trusted, and it's going to become more reliable.
Okay, let's do this. I'm 12 years old right now. I have a blog. I want to make money with the blog. What's my first step? What do I do to make money in the language a 12-year-old would understand?
Okay, so let's say a 12-year-old is listening, and they're passionate about, let's say, Minecraft. That's one of the popular games on the Internet today. You can start creating a blog about Minecraft. The process is pretty simple, so you would just decide what you want to write about. You can talk about how to get skilled up faster on Minecraft and whatnot. So once they figure out the content, they can start putting it out there. And they can actually start engaging on Facebook forums and pages because there's millions of people out there that love Minecraft. You can start building up your audience. You can look for other Minecraft sites out there and start leaving comments. And when you leave a comment on another blog, the name that you leave your comment as will actually link back to your website. So you want to make sure these comments provide a lot of value, and that'll help Google find where your website is and that you're getting links from other different places. And you can actually join the Amazon.com affiliate program. And just because we already have Minecraft in mind, we can promote Minecraft toys, shirts, software, training books, all the different stuff like that. So if you're playing Minecraft and you're like, hey, I got to this new level, it took me 8 hours to figure it out, but then I found out a bunch of cheat codes in this guide. And then if you link to that over to Amazon.com through your affiliate account, anyone else that might be having that same problem might find that article within the search results and then click on that and order through Amazon and earn you some money in the process. So being a 12-year-old, this really wouldn't be earth-shattering to make $12 or $15 in a month if you're like a regular adult person, but for a 12-year-old, that's huge. So once the motivation gets going, really, you can expand this into so many different levels.
Yeah, but Zach, the key is this. We're all 12 years old. when I say that, we're getting into an area that we're not adverse in. And once that happens, it's like speaking Russian to a Chinese audience. So in breaking it down, we're learning in such a way that we can absorb. So when I say talk to the 12-year-old, we're all 12 years old when it comes to this.
Yeah, definitely. And the thing that I see so often is that everybody's always writing down way too many notes. They're trying to learn from way too many people. But at the end of the day, they just need to take action. They can't just keep training and trying to become amazing at something before even starting it. It's like Michael Jordan never became the Jordan he is today by just picking up the basketball and getting that way. It took all the hours and effort to get to where he is. And the same thing holds true with business and creating a blog. You need to just create a site, start from ground zero, and work your way up, because that's the only way you're going to be able to figure this all out.
Yeah, so really what you're dealing with is you started out, and basically there'll be, you know, more readers, go to the advertisers, networking partners, and it's a step-by-step process. I think that's where the key is. It's a skill, and most people don't realize that. You don't just get up and do it. You've got to know the steps to take. This didn't happen for you overnight.
No, definitely not. And I have thousands of people that access my site every day now. But when I was first getting started, I was basically writing for myself and my dog and my family, whoever. But
yeah,
it was basically nobody coming to the site in the beginning. And that's what everybody has to realize. For every success story you hear online, there's another 10,000 failures behind it. And you don't see the 10 years it took for these people to get to where they are today. So you just need to get started today. And because if you start today, you're going to be so much further than if you start a month or
okay,
two
let
weeks
me,
or
let me take you backwards, okay? I have a blog. What do I do with it now?
So once you have a blog and you start creating content for it, the best thing
yeah.
to do is create a valuable resource or something that's better than what's currently out there. And because to rank in the search results, you need to get links from other relevant websites. So let's say, again, you have a Minecraft website and you wanted to start creating art for Minecraft or whatever, just drawing pictures. And if you're advanced at it, you can actually create an infographic to show all the different items you can get through Minecraft. So you create
yeah.
something of value, and then you actually do outreach, contact all the other top Minecraft sites out there, send them an email that say, I really love your content, and based off of the articles you've written, it helps me compile this article, and I even created an infographic. If you'd like to post this to your website, let me know, and I'll provide you with an article that go along with it. So you would really only need a few websites to grab this infographic, place it on their sites, and link back to your site as a reference for your site to raise that much higher in the search results. Because there's millions of sites on the internet, but most of them are just junk and they're all piling together. So once you start getting links from high-value sites that are relevant in your own niche, that's when you're going to rise above the competition.
Okay, so realistically, when it comes down to it, it's okay, let me ask you this. I just changed my mind with the question. How time-consuming is it?
It really depends on what you want to put into it. Somebody can start a blog and put an hour a week into it, or you can put an hour a month into it. Of course, the more time you put into it, the more you're going to do. And it's not just about creating the content. You have to absolutely do the content promotion part. And that's something that people are just going to understand more as they do it, because you can continually keep putting content out there, but with 300 million blogs in the world, you're simply not going to rank in the search results unless you're going extremely niche and getting high-value links to your site.
Okay, let me ask you this. Let's say, for instance, I want to start doing blogs, and I want a blog post, and then I call you. Now, are you taking clients in to do this?
Usually I work with larger brands, but what I created on blogging.org is a complete walkthrough of how anybody can get started with their blog, and it's free for anybody to read through all this information. It walks them through step-by-step, showing them basically how to take a blog and turn it into a business, which goes through the process of picking a niche for your blog, choosing your domain name, setting up your hosting, installing WordPress, going live with your first post, and then gradually walking your way through actually making money with that blog.
Okay, so it's basically your step-by-step is on the website.
Yes, and I did that because it actually makes it easy, because thousands of people are accessing the site every day, and I could literally talk about hosting and blogging and affiliate marketing all day, but it just comes down to a time constraint. So instead of trying to take in clients and do this manually, It's just easy that I created an online course with videos and everything that people can access from anywhere around the world. And it's great because we're seeing a lot of people in countries outside of the United States really get into blogging now, especially in India and Africa. There's just explosive growth, and I'm meeting new people every day through email of them just reading these guides, getting live with their blog, and then sending me questions and feedback along the way.
Wow. Oh. Okay, now we're just about out of time, so let me ask you this. Website we can find you at and get more information and go from there.
Sure. So the name is ZachJohnson.com. If you Google me, Z-A-C, Johnson, I dominate the whole first page. It's all going to be me. You can also go to my sites directly at ZachJohnson.com or blogging.org. And I also have a podcast called Rise of the Entrepreneur. And thanks again so much for having me.
Oh, my absolute pleasure. Okay. And by the way, thank you for all the information, Zach. It's been a pleasure having you on.
Thank you.
Take care. Bye-bye. I'm Michael Dresser.
This is Radio
Try it again.
Susie.
I'm Michael Dresser.
And this is Radio Susie.
And that, my friends, is...
It is a wrap.